Well, Revelation is a picture book, and we've been using this image of it sort of being these feature films, a catalogue of films somewhat, that over our lifetime as a follower of Jesus, they're sort of like our favourite movies that we need to keep revisiting and revisiting, and that each time we come back to each vision, we get a fuller picture, a clearer understanding, and we start to see how it relates to various seasons of our life. And so if chapters 17 to 19 were to be a genre, perhaps they're a thriller, a little bit seductive, pretty dark, and ultimately ends in a wedding. And so I guess sort of really one of the big things that we see through these chapters is the idea of the seductive nature of life in this world. So I thought it'd be good for us to just start thinking, when was the last time that you were seduced by something? You know, that process, you become aware of something, you then become curious, you become more interested, then you experiment, then having experimented, you return, and then you constantly consume or engage. Now, there might be obvious things that come to mind around seduction. Certainly, it is sort of angled towards sexual interaction. But we're seduced by a whole range of things, aren't we? You know, you can be seduced in the Western world by hurry. You know, you just sort of thrive on being busy, efficient, productive. You can be seduced by order, minimalism, low fuss, no distractions, very little waste. You can easily be seduced by pleasure, whether it's entertainment, experiences, food, or sex. Friends, we live in a world full of seduction. There's the allure that we can have power, the enticement of being valued, the attraction of wealth and the security that it brings, that we can be drawn towards a peace and quiet life. Seduction comes in many forms and a variety of degrees. And I think we're all vulnerable to being seduced because life is hard, isn't it? At various points in life, there are alternatives that we become aware of that just seem appealing. They become little fantasies. We don't really see them for the fullness of what they are, but they seem to be offering something that we think we need. If we think about ads, you know, the car ads with just the car on a solo windy road, it's the enticement of having freedom. You know, the cleaning product sort of gives us enticement of just having a home that is uncluttered and undistracted. Or the one that Helena and I have been alluded to most this year is how to store the most amount of stuff in a small kitchen and just watching reels and reels of amazing things. But all these things that seduce us, that they show us something, but they don't give us the full picture, that they show us the result. But often they don't fully outline what's required of us if we want to actually obtain this. They rarely actually outline the true cost that is involved. So as we think about seduction, we've got to realise that it's not something that some people are susceptible to. But in our passage today, we realise that we live in a world that is full of seduction. And so again, we're going to continue this book of Revelation with these vivid and intense visions. Hey, Nath, my clickers. Oh, we're back. He's delayed. Can you just go back a few? Sorry. One more? Great, thanks. And so as we get this vivid image, there's stark contrast, there's rich symbolism. And beyond this vision that, as Martin said, outlines judgment and destruction and ultimate triumph, there's this profound truth that echoes throughout all of history, that despite life being hard, despite the fact that evil often seems to be in control, God is sovereign. His kingdom will advance, and we get to the end of our reading today with the Lamb who ultimately triumphs over all. As we think about living life in this world where seduction is normal and unrelenting, it's this idea of what it means to live in this world that this passage relates to as Babylon. Each day we have a choice as to who will be our master. Will we live according to the ways of this world that we live in, or will we live according to the king, the lamb? And so I'm just not sure how often in church life you've come across someone sharing that they're being seduced by something. I'm starting to see something in my life that I'm drawn towards. I've certainly heard of people after the fact, once they've been seduced by something, sharing of that. But I wonder if we're missing something in church life, that we're actually just not naming the fact that we live in a world that is trying to draw us in, like each of us. It's not like that there's exceptional people who are particularly targeted to seduction. It's something that each of us face. And so what we see in this passage is hopefully a way in which we can recognize that, but navigate our way living in this world where we're going to be seduced by a variety of things. If we have a look at chapter 17, it's a passage that gives us this introduction to the great prostitute and the beast. And it starts with a scene that is both disturbing and mesmerizing. In chapter 17, verses 1 to 2, we're introduced to this figure who's described as the great prostitute, one who is seated on this beast. And again, it's this image that is vivid and almost surreal, a communication that is both spiritual and political in its realities. It's an introduction to this world that chapter 18 will unpack of Babylon. And this great prostitute is a symbol of all corrupt and seductive powers that are drawing people in this world towards worship. Babylon has been the epitome of rebellion against God. And it's not just a city, although it was a city in the ancient world. It is a system. It's a categorized life view that is opposed to the God of the Bible. And so for John, who received this initial vision, this was the Roman Empire. But this is really a timeless vision across all ages for all of us who are awaiting the arrival of Jesus. Babylon really encompasses every system, every idol, every false hope that is promising us life, but that will ultimately lead to destruction. And so perhaps for us in modern Australia, Babylon and its seductive allure draws us into materialism, consumerism, pleasure, things that we just sort of think are normal, sensible, irrational expectations for the good life. Those things that are enticing us with an offer. The things that are offering nourishment for us living in a hard world. I don't know if you saw it this week, but former UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson blamed the Church of England for the obesity problem happening in England. And whilst he's sort of the politician who likes to exaggerate things, it was an interesting thing that we live in a world of choice. We choose one thing over another. And so he's sort of calling out the church for not actually offering spiritual nourishment to their country, and has left them wanting in this hard world, and for many that has been food. And I guess if we look around Sydney this morning, there are people who are choosing exercise, extra sleep, or brunch as their source of nourishment. The city no doubt was filled last night with people partying hard, using drugs, sex, gambling to try and nourish themselves for life in a hard world. And so this lure of Babylon is seeking to provide fantasies for people living in this world to try and cope. And so Babylon, as it sort of stretches all the way back to Babel, back in Genesis, it represents humanity's attempt to try and reach God, to try and interact with God as a peer. And it's really captured in all systems of thinking, institutions of power and control, often that are trying to exploit the vulnerable, who are trying to elevate individuals, and are really trying to sell this message that you can navigate life in this hard world through self-sufficiency. It's really the lie that God's not required. If you have a look down at 17 verses 4 to 5, we're told that this prostitute is arrayed in a purple and scarlet adorning. She's drunk with the blood of the saints. It's sort of shocking imagery of the violence, persecution, and destruction. It's a picture of what evil will inflict upon people in this world as people remove God and seek to live a life of self-sufficiency. But we see also that this woman is dressed in luxury. It's the allure of wealth and indulgence. But the reality is that beneath the outer facade, she's aligned with evil, rebellion, and is ultimately going to drive people towards destruction. And so we've got to realize that as we're in this life of choice between Babylon and the Lamb, that the choice is often going to appear luxury and decadence as opposed to holiness and purity. Often the choice that we face is, are we drawn to focusing on our outward self, or are we going to value our inner character? The lure towards Babylon is often towards things that we can obtain and consume, whereas the things that the Lamb offers is character and promises that will hold us as we live in this world that is broken in so many ways. So if life is navigating this choice, I wonder where you've been most aligning yourself with recently. What are some of the promises of modern day Babylon that are alluring to you? For me, I'm a comfort and approval guy. If I can sort of find a path of least resistance, I will usually take it. If I'm met with a human in front of me, I'll just want to make them happy. But maybe for you, it's about power. It's about always winning. Maybe for you, it's just about being able to control and know every little detail of everything, not just in your life, but in the life of those around you. Perhaps for others, it's just this desire for security and just the fear of anything going wrong. We live in a world where we're going to be pulled in a whole range of directions. And this shouldn't be a surprise. Have a look at chapter 17, verse 7 and 8. Why are you astonished? It's a revelation for us to not be surprised at the fact that we get seduced into things that will ultimately destroy us. You see, this woman and the beast are sort of producing this historical cycle of evil. There are going to be various power structures that rise and fall, and history the last 2,000 years since this revelation came to John have shown that. But what is normal and accepted for one generation, others will look at and think, it's astonishing. Like, I think probably a few of us here can probably remember, not me, but when, you know, train carriages were filled with people smoking, where people smoked at their desk, where nurses and doctors smoked in hospitals, like, it just sounds ridiculous. But in that day, it was just normal. And so it is in Babylon that we just become so accustomized to the ways in which we're being presented with what is normal that often we won't see the destructive nature of evil. And now the seven kings and the ten horns, again, they're sort of both specific and figurative here, representing past and future empires. Again, that the seven symbolizes the fullness of the oppressive powers that are going to face against God. The ten horns represents, I think, more of a coalition that even sort of dividing and conflicted parties will come together against God and his ways. You see, Babylon isn't just the minority view. When people sort of say, oh, the problem with this world is that there's just a few bad apples, that's not what the Bible presents. What we see here in this vision is that the majority view, the view that is most influential, most well-resourced, is a view that is opposed to God. But the good news that we hear is that Babylon will eventually be exposed and a great and decisive judgment will come upon her. The prostitute who rides this beast are the very powers that seem so aligned, and the collusion that they have against God will eventually end one day. And so chapter 18 gives us this picture of the fact that Babylon will fall. And so have a look there in chapter 18, verses 1 to 2, where the angel declares that the great city has become a home for demons. It's become this haunt for every kind of evil spirit. But despite its influence, Babylon will eventually fail. And so the warning that the angel brings in chapter 18, verse 4, is that God's people wouldn't get caught up in the seduction of Babylon and its ways. It's this encouragement, this warning, this urging, come out. Friends, we live in an age of seduction, and the angel here calls God's people to be separated from the ways and thinking, to remain loyal to their true king. None of us are immune to seduction. We all, at some level, are participating. There are things in this world that we find alluring. But the reminder here is that these things that perhaps seem so normal, seem so appealing, will eventually pass away. And just like if you're still trying to get your head around a doctor doing a surgery while they're having a fag, and just think that is just ridiculous, so too, those things that might seem so necessary and normal for you today, one day in the future you look back and go, that was just so empty. Babylon is offering a counterfeit. It's temporary satisfaction, but it will produce eternal emptiness. And so the call for God's people, as we live in Babylon, as we live in this world where seduction is real and near, is to pursue holiness, to be distinct, to live knowing that we are citizens of a different kingdom. So it means that we're going to be abnormal, which for an approval guy, that's not great. To stand out, to not participate in things that everyone just sort of says, well, that's just what you need to make it in this industry. Hey, that's just the way that we roll here. To uphold another way, another value set. To orchestrate your diary in a way that is countercultural, that your bank balance distributes money away from yourself rather than toward. This is life living for the Lamb. And so the message from our passage today is a strong and clear message that seductions will come towards us. And so I think as a church community, we need to be sharing that, sharing the things that we're finding we're just being a little bit too interested about, just trying to unpack what is it about that we're finding appealing. And we also need models of how people live for this kingdom, live for the Lamb rather than living for Babylon. So I've talked a little bit about my friend who's recently retired, who lived a life in ministry seeking this mantra of seeking first the kingdom of God. And I was walking with him, particularly the last few years, heading up to his retirement, and you know, he was feeling the weight of the fact that he had very little superannuation and earthly ways to navigate life without income. He's currently, and his wife, caretaking a campsite in remote Australia and just having a great time. And just, again, trusting in the promise that those who seek first his kingdom, all these other things will be given to you. Friends, we need to model and share the stories of what it looks like to live for this kingdom that is otherworldly. This kingdom that will last because it will help us see the emptiness of the fantasies that are presented to us daily. And so eventually all will be exposed. And if you have a look at chapter 18, verse 10 to 11, there is going to be mourning over these things that the world thought were so impressive, but eventually crumble. And so for any of you who have studied history, you'll know that empires have come and gone. Leaders have come, risen, and then been forgotten. Organizations have been influential and then gone to nothing. I was watching the documentary on the Murdoch family recent on ABC, and there's this interesting thing for those who were around back in the early 2000s. James Packer and Lachlan Murdoch, the two sort of heirs to the throne, they invested in this new technology company called OneTel. It's just like, oh, these guys are smart and well-resourced, and they just lost a whole lot of money. So it was interesting hearing from them both 25 years later. Well-educated, well-resourced individuals going, we completely got that wrong. And so too, we live in this world where Babylon is trying to build up particular things, but there will be mourning when they look back and see that what looks so secure, it looked like such a sure thing about how you should live your life, will eventually be shown as something that went totally wrong. Chapter 18, verse 21 is a confronting image about the end. Babylon is eventually going to be destroyed. And it's not like just like, you know, the phone company Nokia, that at one point in the history of the world was the most advanced phone company in the world, but then just failed to adapt, and now probably the younger guys have never even heard of them. It's not just that Babylon got outsmarted. It's that Babylon, in its disposition of being opposed to God in all its various forms, will eventually just crush. And so this final day, this act of God bringing justice and mercy when he makes all things that are so wrong with this world right, is the hope that is presented for those who are in the Lamb's Book of Life. And so chapter 19, verses 1 to 10, then gives us this picture about what we look forward to. The mood shifts dramatically from mourning over the destruction of Babylon. Now, in chapter 19, we hear the joy in the great celebration of the redeemed. In chapter 19, verses 5 to 6, The multitude of voices that they cry out, hallelujah, salvation and glory and power belong to our God. Chapter 19, it's this picture of heaven erupting in praise because God has finally exposed things for what they are. And what is revealed is that the Lamb is the true King. Friends, this is the climax of history, the ultimate victory of the Lamb over evil. And so with evil dealt with and this world set right, God's people are now brought into an eternal union with him. And so as opposed to the prostitute who was riding the beast, now it's the bride and the Lamb in this wedding union, a marriage that symbolizes the fulfillment of God's purposes. And we see here that God is always just deeply relational. His plan has always been about being united to his people. And so this love story that began back in Genesis in the garden, that it had so many rocky roads, eventually now comes to be realized in this wedding banquet. And so for those whose name is in the Lamb's Book of Life, we are the bride of Christ. And the encouragement here is to prepare ourselves for that wedding day. But that's the focus. To live on what's eternal. To pursue what is pure and right. To fix our eyes on the bridegroom. To remain faithful. And so it's going to require intention because the seductions are going to be many and varied. We live in a world where compromise and infidelity to our God is going to be constant. But the goal is this final union, preparing ourselves to meet our groom. Now, for anyone who's been married, you know, preparing for a marriage is not about knowing less about the person that you're marrying. It's about showing some more interest. It's about trying to understand the way that they see things, exploring the things that they love, even if they are foreign to you. And so too, as we live in this age of seduction, it's the pursuit of what God sees as good. It's about trying to understand why what he says is evil is actually evil and learning to hate it. It's a life anticipating eternity where we will be with our groom forever. And so as we live in this age of seduction where we're constantly given the choice, Babylon or the Lamb, let's be honest that temptation is going to be real. But let's remind one another of the great offer that we have. This great union forever with God. So perhaps as a church, one thing we want to make sure is that we don't just sort of try and pretend that life's easy. Like just come here and just talk about, oh, how's your week, and just sort of keep it at this superficial. I'm sure there's appropriate ways in which these conversations are had. But certainly, at least, let's be real that we live in the age of seduction. And seduction is a process from awareness to full consumption. And at each point, there's the invitation to remind ourselves and remind one another of the hope that is found, that the better hope, the lasting hope that is found in the Lord Jesus. And so, as Martin said, one of the ways in which we remember these promises of God is that we celebrate the Lord's Supper to remember that God is embodied and we are going to relate to him entirely, that we're not just here doing something conceptual. We're not here to try and pass a test. So we're going to partake in the Lord's Supper now. Try and